From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. A new report from the Modern Language Association encourages humanities departments to make major revisions in the graduate experience and the dissertation process. At a small but seemingly growing number of institutions, faculty are having their Howard Beale moment. They're madder than hell, and they're not going to take it anymore, leading to faculty votes of no confidence in a growing number of presidents. And the recent tragic shootings in Santa Barbara again raise questions about presidential roles and institutional responsibilities. Hi. This is Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. Our panelists for the conversation this week are Rosemary Fayal, who is the Executive Director of the Modern Language Association and also is a professor of Spanish at SUNY, the University of Buffalo. Susan Resnick-Pierce is the president of SRP Consulting and president emerita of the University of Puget Sound. And Scott Jasek is the founding editor of Inside Higher Ed. Susan, Rosemary, and Scott, welcome to you all. And to our audience, ahead of our conversation, please note you can post comments on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. Group, let's go to the headlines. I want to begin with the Modern Language Association, which urges major reform in the graduate experience for students in the humanities. On Wednesday, the MLA released a major report, 2 years in the making, intended to address, quote, an unsustainable reality, a median time to degree around 9 years for language and literature doctoral students, and a long-term academic job market that provides tenure-track employment for only around 60% of the doctoral recipients. Rosemary, let me direct the first couple of questions to you. Why now? I mean, these issues about time to degree, the report's call for broader career paths, an emphasis on strengthening teacher preparation, a depressing labor market are not new. These are things that have been the hallmarks of the labor market for humanities PhDs for a very long time, some might argue several decades. What makes the recommendations in this new report different and distinctive from past efforts?
Good morning, Casey. It's great to be on the phone with you and Scott and Susan. Thanks so much for asking about the MLA report. It has indeed been a long time in the making. Here's why it's different. The forms of scholarship themselves have been evolving, and many graduate programs have yet to adapt to these changes. Also, PhDs are engaging in many careers outside the academy, and they are pretty much invisible to their departments and to the field at large. And as you say, it simply takes too long, and I think we've also reached a turning point where everyone recognizes that this problem can be solved, and we have new ways to solve it.
So what are those new ways, and why is it distinctive now as opposed to perhaps a decade ago or 2 decades ago or even 3 decades ago, where some humanities programs were aligning themselves with MBA programs or mini-MBA programs to provide different career paths for humanities PhDs?
Primarily because what's occurring is in the PhD programs themselves. By introducing creative flexibility in the programs, along with the high intellectual standards that we expect of the PhD, we're doing the work where the PhDs are, as opposed to a joint program with an MBA or similar. Also, the entire university community and the outside community are beginning to collect around what we might call the public humanities and so on. And I think these opportunities simply didn't exist in any form, they did not exist in the forms that they do today 20, 30 years ago. And the tipping point, I think, has been reached, and graduate students are now demanding that their programs prepare them more widely for not only careers outside the academy, but for all the careers in the academy that might range from community college teaching to administration in colleges and universities to not-for-profits. So I think we're seeing graduate students demanding change as well.
You know, I think for many of us with long memories, Rosemary, some of this sounds a little bit like the conversation some decades ago about the Doctors of Arts degree. More emphasis on teaching, a reduced dissertation experience. Again, at the risk of politely pressing, how is this different, or how will this make a difference?
First of all, it wouldn't be a reduced doctoral dissertation experience. It would be a different doctoral experience. So, for example, we are seeing doctoral students work in collaboration on matters such as textual coding, on projects that take them from the classroom into the wider community. These are not watering downs. These are value added to what they're already studying. It's also different because, as you know, the Doctor of Arts degree pretty much died out. I think there's one remaining right now, and was not a successful alternative to the PhD. The demand for the PhD in languages and literatures continues to be high. We even have students who return at age 40, 50 to get a doctorate because they're interested in advanced studies in the humanities. So I think we're preserving the core of what's good and important about the PhD, in this case, in languages and literatures. So it's not an alternative to, it's a reform of.
Susan Resnick-Pierce, let me bring you into the conversation. You've seen both sides of this coin. As part of our preparation for the call, you mentioned that you were on an MLA task force some time ago as a new graduate student, new PhD, looking at some of these very same issues. And on the other hand, you've also been a college president who, one might argue, has been the beneficiary of a down labor market in terms of an ample labor pool, in terms of hiring options and opportunities. What's your take on the MLA report?
A couple of quick things. In 1972, I represented all unemployed PhDs in English and foreign languages on the MLA Advisory Committee on the job market. And at that time, we were quite cognizant that there was an overproduction of PhDs in those two fields. But the universities that were producing most of the new doctorates were reluctant to become smaller because they were relying on graduate students to be their TAs. I think that, and I really appreciate the work that the people who did this latest report have put into it and how well-intended they are, and I agree about needing to compress the time frame and perhaps to rethink some of the practices. My biggest concern, and there are two of them, and I'll be quick about this, one is the expectation for the PhD granting faculty is that more of them will be doing more, and again, in a more compressed period of time. Currently, one dissertation advisor really serves as the mentor to the graduate student. This envisions a team doing that. It envisions people from other disciplines more actively involved in these new notions of what a dissertation might be. So I expect you're going to find a lot of resistance at the level of the graduate faculty members for this. In terms of the hiring campuses, I think that there has been a sea change since the early 70s when small private colleges, branch campuses, in other words, institutions that were not research one institutions, were able to hire graduate students from the very best research programs in the country. And that led to a change in expectation for faculty, in part driven by the new faculty members themselves who had been trained to do research and wanted to continue to do so and began to push their campuses to reduce teaching loads, reduce class size, provide more support for research and scholarship. And on the other hand, the campuses began, and I'm generalizing, but I think it's pretty true, began to think that having a research faculty would bring them prestige. And so we've seen a reduction in teaching loads. Now that we're running up against these financial pressures, I think we're going to see resistance from faculty on the hiring campuses to focus more on teaching at the expense of research because that might well mean that they're going to have to teach more than they currently are.
Scott, Inside Higher Ed has devoted a lot of coverage to the whole issue of the role of adjuncts, the rising role of adjuncts in lots of different campuses, not just in community colleges. The report itself makes a very firm statement saying that Departments should not reduce enrollments. There should not be it should not be a matter of reducing the number of students in graduate programs, because that would have consequences for access. On the other hand, if I'm an adjunct, if I'm a PhD in humanities who's been a gypsy for several years, spending my time and trying to create a career across several campuses, I might look at that statement as being very self-serving, that, as Susan was saying, it's in the benefit of departments both for tuition revenue on enrollments and also institutions in terms of having a low-cost teaching force of graduate students at their institutions. Is that a fair assessment for those who might look at that particular part of the report?
Well, there's another part of the report, though, that I think plays into this, and that is that the report calls for full support for, I believe, 5 years. And so what the MLA is saying is it should be possible to earn a PhD in the amount of time that you receive full support. I think the reality is today, many of those adjuncts, not only did they not find the jobs they were hoping to find with the sort of job security and benefits that they feel they've earned, but they're carrying debt. They've been doing this for 10 years. If the MLA can bring about this change, they might see more people who are working outside of academia, who are not leaving their doctoral programs already in a severe financial disadvantage. Now, the jobs side of this in part depends on the decisions of colleges to create positions or not, and it's definitely related, but if colleges that can't provide full support stop admitting students without support, that might be some retrenchment aside from just saying we're shrinking programs to shrink programs.
So, Rosemary, I'm assuming that as part of the process, members of the committee did some assessment of their own institutions in terms of the five-year support issue that Scott just mentioned. And yet, at the same time, we know that the humanities, perhaps more so than other units on campus, typically are at the front end of many of the budget cuts that campuses have experienced during down cycles like the one that we're trying to come out of. Is it realistic for many departments at both elite and non-elite institutions, is it realistic to expect departments at elite and non-elite institutions to be able to provide that full 5 years?
Let's back up a minute. When we talk about the faculty resisting ideas such as those presented in this report, we also have to consider that many faculty members are clamoring for solutions to what everyone recognizes is unsustainable. There are 12 case studies in the report of institutions from Ivy Leagues to regional schools, including institutions such as Stanford, University of Michigan, University of Virginia, where already reforms have been put into place at faculty and student initiatives, and they're working. Everything from students getting certificates in public humanities to collaborating on digital projects together and so on. So faculty members want solutions. Back to what Susan said about the changing mission of undergraduate institutions, it's really important to stress that mission alignment and teaching opportunities, or teaching load, as some call it, need to change. Institutions that have adopted an R1 research mission and yet are fundamentally about undergraduate teaching are doing a disservice to students and faculty. And these things need to change, and at many institutions they are. So I would say that the resistance on part of faculty, which is normal, can change. And when leadership is in place that says, look, these are our graduate students, and they need to be able to finish in a reasonable amount of time, and we need to be able to find the ways to support them to do that, leadership can help make this happen. And I have seen through these case studies and in talking to faculty at many institutions a will to do this. So I don't buy the faculty resistance argument as an obstacle to this kind of change. And yes, 5 years funding is entirely reasonable and is the norm at many institutions.
All right. Money is clearly at the heart of a lot of this in terms of the institutional costs as well as the costs for graduate students. Money, as we switch topics, also is very much at the heart of our next topic in terms of faculty and their Howard Beale moments. On campuses across the country, faculty do seem to be having these Howard Beale moments, a reference to the movie Network, people screaming out their windows, madder than hell and not willing to take it anymore. We're seeing evidence of discord and dissent reflected on faculty websites, and what seem to be the rising reports of faculty votes of no confidence in a variety of institutions. Susan, you wrote about this recently at Inside Higher Ed. What's your take about what's going on?
Well, I think you've got two sides of an equation happening right now, Casey. The first is that on the one hand, the financial pressures are really encouraging, if not forcing, boards and often presidents to make very difficult institutional decisions and in terms of how to allocate resources. And up until recently, the faculty and academic programs have been sacred ground, and there has been an understandable reluctance to try to make changes there. The financial pressures have become so strong that many institutions have begun to eliminate programs. Emory is a perfect example, a year ago, getting rid of any number of programs without reportedly real consultation with the faculty. And so you find faculty members, as you suggest, very much resisting what they see as a failure of shared governance, a top-down administrative approach rather than people working collaboratively. The other side of the equation is, however, that the faculty traditions of extended deliberation about all sorts of matters and the difficulty, I think, and I was a faculty member for a long time, but the difficulty for people to think institutionally and agree to make decisions that might harm either their own interests or that of their colleagues has led, I think, to this kind of clash that you just characterized. So I think that the problem is that in some ways we have a clash of cultures and a real need to make decisions. What I argue in my new book, Governance Reconsidered, is that both faculty members and boards and presidents need to understand that academic values are at the core of all that we do, but people really have to join in the conversation in good faith.
Scott, there seems to be some irony here. I mean, it is the case that most presidents and provosts are former faculty members. They've worked their way up the ranks, and yet I'm thinking about the surveys that Inside Higher Ed has done of provosts over the last several years, and as I recall, large numbers of provosts just think many faculty on their campus don't get it in terms of fully understanding the levels of financial challenge and risk that confront their institutions.
That's certainly their response, and when you talk to presidents and provosts, many will say that faculty, particularly their faculty critics, are unrealistic or naive, they will say. My question back to them is, have you brought them into the discussion? It's much easier, I think, to say, well, the faculty don't understand our financial challenges, move too slowly, as opposed to opening the books and inviting ideas. We're seeing it's in the news today, University of Southern Maine, where faculty pretty much revolted over a series of budget cuts, have come back and proposed several million dollars in cuts to avoid the plan they don't like. So I worry about this sense of they won't ever come up with ideas that reflect the realities. And I say, have you tried?
Rosemary, the humanities are often at the front end of a lot of these cuts that are either volunteered or imposed. You know, play that out against our conversation a few moments ago in terms of the commitments that campuses will have to make some investment of time and cash to redevelop their programs, a long-term commitment or the five-year commitment to graduate students. How does this sort of play out as you look at it both as the executive of the MLA, but also in your other life as a faculty member at SUNY Buffalo?
You know, it's interesting because I agree completely with Susan. If faculty members are involved in the process, then they can help shape it. And what I've seen, especially in the humanities, is programs often get cut, and it's dropped like a surprise bomb during budget planning at a college or university. What needs to happen is departments should be engaged in conversations about what constitutes successful programs, how to achieve them, how they can be measured, and then departments know on what criteria they are being judged. So this is what I hear from MLA members in departments, that they would like to be partners in creating academic success, but very often the measures that are imposed are mysterious. So transparency, collaboration, and conversation around the values and the mission seem to me missing ingredients in some of these situations.
Susan, drawing on your experience as both a president and a consultant to many institutions, it seems that for a large number of campuses, public and private, large and small, the great revenue hope for many seems to be online education, to launch or to expand current efforts. And yet we know that colleges do a terrible job in terms of cost accounting. We know that colleges, that there's a lot of decentralized command and control over these programs. Is that a realistic expectation that revenue from online ed is going to solve these problems for many campuses?
Well, I think the notion that that was going to be the panacea is something that people are questioning quite seriously now. Certainly, 2 years ago, everybody was talking about MOOCs as being the salvation to higher education, and that has turned out not to be the case, at least so far. I know of very few instances where institutions have saved money by using online education or have been able to do so really effectively. I think it's happening, however. So I think the jury is still out on that. I think a lot of places are beginning to look at this very seriously. I'd like to go back to the other conversation for just a quick second, if I might. I am absolutely with Scott that I think that, and Rosemary both, that I think administrators really do need to open up the conversation, open up their books, and be candid with the faculty and encourage collaboration. I can tell you, however, that I know of lots of campuses where that's happened, some where it's worked, and others where even in the face of significant structural deficits and spending down the endowment at unreasonable rates, members of the faculty are refusing to cooperate with any change at all in the institution. One campus that I know of, they've not been a client, but I know them well, the faculty has said that they will not do anything new unless they're paid extra for it, including talking to prospective students. So I think we need to be a little wary of overgeneralizing. There may be some principles that may well work, but institutional culture and history have a lot to do with it as well.
Certainly does. Scott, what else do we need to know about this? I mean, in one sense, it seems like there's an odd lag in this current wave of no-confidence votes driven by what we might call command, control, and cash issues. You know, for many campuses, public and private, are coming out of the crisis. Yeah, there was a slight enrollment dip that disproportionately affected some more than others. But in some sense, the real crisis is in many ways sort of past, and yet that would have been the time to see these no-confidence votes, and now, you know, it's almost as if there's a two-year lag in some cases.
Well, I guess I think for many private, non-wealthy institutions, the crisis is actually just hitting because they spent their rainy day funds, they increased their discount rates, they did things to get through the worst of it, and now they're stuck with structural deficits and not enough students. And this is leading to some of these debates. Where I see a lot of the concern are on online are whether new online programs are viable, whether enrollment projections in certain programs are viable. Clearly, some places are making a lot on online MBAs or various programs. The question of whether institutions can just get into this game or just add, quote, you know, high-demand programs and instantly have success, I think that's not tested, and a lot of faculty are dubious of that, and some universities are putting money into that and failing. And at the same time, going back to the issue of whether humanities are disproportionately cut, many faculty criticize the idea of basing these things on, say, number of majors as opposed to contribution to the overall education. If you look at, if you talk to scientists, most of them don't want scientists who have only studied STEM. But if you approach these things by how many majors we have, you may constantly be eliminating programs that contribute to general education and other fields.
Good points. I want to move to our third topic, which involves guns, violence, and college presidents. The tragic shootings in Santa Barbara this past weekend again raised questions about what position, if any, college presidents might or should take in the public discussion about guns and violence on or around college campuses, and also what role or responsibility college and universities might have to report students who might have mental health issues that could lead to violence. As reported in an article that appeared this week at Inside Higher Ed, Lauren Shaw, who's the president of Oglethorpe University in Georgia, where clearly gun control is a political issue, quote, has repeatedly said he could think of no other issue on which so many college leaders could agree, much less speak out. And while he acknowledged this week that some presidents might not support a public call or demand, he suggested that in some cases the willingness or unwillingness of presidents to speak out on these issues involve other political issues. Scott, let's talk about the politics. Have the politics that seem to be out at play and the highly sort of polarized positions on these issues in Congress and other areas now come to college campuses?
Well, certainly with this issue, it's very difficult for presidents to speak out, even on direct higher ed ramifications of gun issues. A number of states have passed laws making it impossible for public colleges to regulate guns on their campuses, and not respecting the traditional view of campuses that there may be particular reasons, whatever you think of gun control, that you don't want guns in, say, dormitories or just around campus generally. And presidents have been largely ignored when they've spoken out on that issue in many states. And really what President Shaw is saying is, looking at what happened in California, looking at other tragedies, that presidents should just be lending their moral voice to this cause. He cites the Father Hesburgh at Notre Dame, who was a leader in the civil rights movement. Many have pointed out that there aren't a lot of Father Hesburghs around anymore, and people aren't used to turning to presidents these days for guidance. You know, maybe higher ed would be better off if they did see presidents in that way.
Susan, no Father Hesburghs because the politics are too divisive or because the presidents are no longer protected in the way they might once have been?
Well, I think it's even more complicated than that. I think that when the shift came from college presidents being the person who articulates the moral vision of their institution to having to spend a certain percentage of their time fundraising and being evaluated on their success as fundraisers. And by the way, I think that good presidents are more than chief development officers and really are leaders of their institution. But there have been a number of decades where I think presidents have been reluctant to speak out on any controversial issues simply because they've been worried that they might alienate some donor. And also because, as a president, when you speak, you can't really speak personally. People always assume that what you say is representing the institution. So I think for many of us who were or are presidents, that's a very delicate line. Having said all of that, I think that we do have a responsibility to speak out on issues that deal with either our missions or, as in the case of gun violence, the health and integrity of our campuses. So I believe that this is one of those issues where presidents should speak out.
What about faculty speaking out, Rosemary? I mean, you know, this issue is not just one of presidential positioning or and presidential authority, but also institutional responsibility. If a student in your class at SUNY Buffalo or in a class someplace else clearly is sending signals of distress, whether that's in conversations with a faculty member or a mental health counselor on campus, you know, what's the institutional responsibility? What's the responsibility of individual faculty members here in terms of notifying public authorities?
The responsibility should be clearly articulated by the university itself. Under good presidential leadership, as Susan just pointed out, you will have clear policies and clear instructions to faculty members about what to do when they encounter the issues such as you mentioned. At my institution, where I've been on leave now for 12 years, but when I was a faculty member and had situations like that, I would pick up the phone and call the Dean of Students' office and basically turn it over. And I think that faculty members are trained today to notice and to act. I also think faculty members have a responsibility to speak out and to expect that the well-being of campus citizens is at the forefront of administrators' planning and thinking. And certainly in a case like what we saw at UC Santa Barbara, the students there and campuses in general that experience gun violence, that is a clear case in which speaking out is necessary and action is necessary to protect students and faculty and all campus citizens.
Yeah, our conversation on any of these topics could continue. Unfortunately, it can't. So, Pamela, I'd like to offer you each a last opportunity for a quick comment. What have we missed in the events of this past week, or what should we be attending to with things that may be coming at higher education in the coming weeks? Rosemary, let me begin with you.
Oh, I think for me the big news this week was the death of the great American writer and professor Maya Angelou. It's hard to believe that 45 years have passed since the publication of I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. That's a work that just profoundly changed American lit and how it's taught in colleges and universities.
Susan?
I like that idea. I'd go back to something that Scott just said a few minutes ago that I think needs to be better understood, that many colleges, and I would include some of the public campuses as well as the private, are really not coming out of the recession, but are really beginning to experience significant structural deficits that are leading to not only the kind of contentiousness we just talked about, but very serious changes in institutional mission and offerings. A year ago, enrollments at private colleges of fewer than 4,000 students was down 83%. And although I don't know, the numbers clearly are not in for the current year, the reports that I'm getting from people around the country are that many, many good institutions, and these are both public and private, are again suffering significant enrollment declines. So I think that for people to really understand what is happening and begin a conversation about how institutions can deal with this, short of the kind of draconian method that we saw, for example, at Iowa Wesleyan, which after 117 years of really being a good small private college with strong liberal arts programs, has now decided that it's only going to offer degrees in business education and nursing, and they've cut something like half their faculty and staff.
Scott, last comment before we close.
Sure. I would say that the MLA report is actually points to a broader challenge for higher education, which is just sort of how do new people come into the professoriate? And the MLA report is about English language and foreign language programs. But if you look at the debate in the sciences over whether there are too much time in postdocs or social sciences dealing with some of the same issues about non-academic careers, this is an academe-wide issue right now that I think we're going to see more and more discussion of.
Great. Those are all good and important comments for us to close the program. My thanks to Rosemary Fayal, Susan Resnick-Pierce, and Scott Jasek for being with us today. And our thanks to you, our audience, for joining us for this edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. This Week is available as an audio stream or podcast beginning at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on most Fridays. On the web, you can find us at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your comments about the program with us on the comments section of the This Week webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.